Hello, welcome to another questionably adapted episode of Saved by the 90s. My name is Adam Patterson. With me today is a guy who frequently spent his life savings at the Scholastic Book Fair, Mr. Ken Bagley. Hey, Ken.
Hey, and you know that might be true because when you're nine, what are your life savings than just whatever money you happen to have on your person at the time?
You guys, you still had this, that was still a thing when you were in school,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, it was for me, and I actually did buy something from a couple of times, but I kind of stopped because I had this unique ability to buy books and find out that they were, like, sequels to books I hadn't
read. Yeah, I've been there.
So I'd buy these books, and I'd, like, open them, read the first page, and the first page would be, like, some, like, the first person narrator going, like, well, as you've guessed, this is a sequel to another book. And then I would just put it on the shelf and never look at it again.
I would always go for the Goosebumps. That was like my jam. I had a pretty massive Goosebumps collection.
I should have steered more towards things that I already knew what they were. I was trying to be adventurous and that did not pay off ever.
Were Goosebumps a thing when you were at the book?
Yeah, definitely. But I tried to buy things that I hadn't heard of before and that didn't pay off because I didn't know what they were.
Yeah, I just went with, like, straight up anything that looked like it might be scary. And then I half the time I didn't read it. Like, I had a massive Goosebumps collection, and I don't think I probably read maybe a quarter of them. And I used to be a big reader, but then, like, at some point in my schooling, it just completely dropped off, and I stopped altogether. But I still bought books, which was kind of funny. Anyway, this month on the show, we'll be bringing you four literary adaptations released in November throughout the decade. So get those reading glasses on because this is Saved by the 90s.
A hero to all the kids. But now Captain Planet fights his toughest battle.
I didn't know rats spread AIDS. I'm talking about spreading hate and ignorance.
A special episode of Captain Planet and the Planeteers at a special time. Sunday at 8 Eastern on TNT.
First up, we'll be discussing an adaptation of a classic novel that was originally published in 1897, but continues to influence every form of media to this day. Directed by Francis Ford Coppola and released on November 13, 1992, this is Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Critics are saying dazzling, romantic, alluring, classic, unforgettable, lavish. Astonishing.
I am Dracula.
Dracula!
Words can persuade you, but nothing can prepare you. Bram Stoker's Dracula, a Francis Ford Coppola film. Rated R at theaters now.
Now, if you're paying attention, the buzzwords there spelled out Dracula.
Ooh.
Not sure if you caught that or not.
I did not. I'm very bad at things like that.
I wouldn't have it. I mean, I watched the trailer and that's how I know. I wouldn't have picked up on it otherwise. When Dracula leaves the captive Jonathan Harker in Transylvania for London in search of Mina Harker, the reincarnation of Dracula's long-dead wife, Elisabetta, obsessed vampire hunter Dr. Van Helsing sets out to end the madness.
Can he end the madness of that synopsis?
Well, you know, the first thing that I'd mention is that they're not married. Her name's not Mina Harker at the beginning. They get married later on in the movie. But so that's like the first issue that I have here. Not a great synopsis there. Anyway, Ken, what were your initial impressions of Bram Stoker's Dracula?
This movie is chaos, and that's pretty great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love the chaos. There's a beautiful chaos to some of the movies we'll be discussing today, and it'll be fun to talk about them.
I do like this version of Dracula a lot. I've seen this movie a few times now, and for all its weird choices that Francis Ford Coppola made in the making of this, I find a lot of this movie to be just so endearing. Mostly from a visual perspective, like all of the flourishes that he uses. I mean, he just goes wild with the style.
This is such a great looking movie.
It's everything in this movie is so over stylized. Every little detail is just completely overdone, and I love it. I mean, they open up with the the sort of iconic body armor that Gary Oldman has as Dracula before, when he's still a man, in this like flashback sequence, and it's like this kind of musculature armor stuff. And I mean, that's that in and of itself, I think, is iconic. And it's just almost every sequence has at least one notable thing, be it like a specific camera shot or a piece of clothing or the set design. I mean, the production design in this movie is out of control. It just looks so good. I mean,
yes,
this movie is like a visual feast, and I absolutely love it. I really like gothic horror stories, and I think that this movie just completely just owns it, just ravishes in its over the top glory. And there's a lot of small things too. Like early on, there's a scene when, if I'm not mistaken, I think that it's when Keanu Reeves, who plays Jonathan Harker, when he's like on the train going to Transylvania, and he's writing a letter to Winona Ryder, who plays his fiance, and that shot where you see the train going at the top of the screen and then him writing the letter, I just think that is such a cool looking shot. I really love that.
Yeah, and it's there's so many great overlays in this movie. Mm-hmm. Just layered shots with lots of stuff going on, and that's not to make, be reductive about it, but it's just a movie that just so heavily utilizes every element at its disposal, just because, I mean, the first thing that we have to think about it is, this is just such a, like, the elements of the story are just so, by their nature, grandiose. I feel like almost when we think about, like, classic horror stories or classic horror devices, we tend to, like, not sanitize, but just kind of think of them as, like, simplistic, or we think of them as just somehow floating above the way we would otherwise tell a story. But this movie, and just like developing its own spin on these characters and this narrative, it is so corporeal. It is just so much about like bodies and physical being and just transformation and these states of being. And it's just so like intimately about that and explores it in every single way. And that just kind of does contribute to this idea of a movie which has an aesthetic and just a feel that is just so immediately physical.
Unfortunately, I feel like for every singular element that this has going for it, it has at least one going against it. It's a movie that feels very of the era to me, even though it takes place in the 1800s. It just feels like such a 90s movie to me. I don't know what about it makes it feel that way. I know that Keanu Reeves' performance doesn't help. It doesn't help matters, because no matter how hard he tries, he just cannot sell the fact that he is a guy living in like 1869 and it is British. Like, that's just not that's not happening for him. He feels like a surfer dude.
There's like, almost a degree to which if people do know this movie but haven't seen it, the one of the things they're likely to know is this kind of infamous Keanu Reeves performance. And the main problem is the accent. Really, because honestly, if I didn't know that's what he was trying to affect, I would genuinely not have known that he was trying to play a character with like late 19th century styled English accent.
And I think maybe one of the things that makes it more glaring is the fact that he's often acting opposite Gary Oldman, who just relishes this performance. I mean, he owns it, and he's so incredible in this role,
and he's just having such a good time in it.
The fact that he goes through so many transformations, like physically and seemingly emotionally throughout this movie, it's so impressive. I mean, he's clearly an incredible actor, and I liked all the makeup work too. I think that it should be highlighted that he looked like all the makeup work that they did with him. Because, I mean, he goes through like various transformations. I mean, he starts out as a young guy in the flashback, and then he's like super old and creepy, which is probably, you know, the most notable form that he's in this movie, like the one that people mm-hmm. most often think of with the hairdo, the crazy hair, and that really incredible scene where his shadow is like moving separately from him, and that whole sequence I thought was really incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And just generally the effects work in this movie I thought was overall like really, really solid.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I will revisit from time to time, and just I don't want to say that it's like a great movie, or maybe even not a good movie necessarily, but
I think it's a good movie.
I always have fun with it. I always have a good time with this movie.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the you had mentioned like sort of the layers of this movie, and like how they Coppola does so many of these like superimposed shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the overlaying images on images.
I would say that most of them, like 80% of them, do not work and end up looking super hokey. I love that
there's so many of them.
They're so hokey at times that I'm just like, oh my god. There's just so many eye-rolling moments in this movie, but I think that in a lot of ways, especially watching it now so many years later, just gives it a little bit more charm. And and you have Winona Ryder is she's very good in this. Anthony Hopkins is incredible in this. I sort of forgot how awesome he was as Van Helsing in this. Like he he plays such a character, and he seems to be having a really great time in this role as well. And I thought that he was really great in this too. And then you have some really great smaller roles in here too, like Tom Waits as Renfield, who's like the sort of crazed lackey of Dracula. And he had those crazy glove thing, the hand things, and then like all the stuff in the asylum I thought was great, like the crazy cage things that the orderlies would wear. I loved all of that.
I think another thing that kind of makes the Reeves performance kind of stand out in a negative way is that it just so feels like every other part of this movie, everyone else's performance, every part of the production design of the movie and the cinematography is just operating on the exact same like cranked up level, that anyone who is not meeting that extraordinarily like spectacular level stands out. like in another movie, yes, you would have a bad performance and there'd be a bad performance, but it's just that this is a movie that's just operating on such a level that everyone has to be meeting it at all times, just because it is just there's just it's just so much.
Yeah, I was a little concerned about Winona Ryder's performance in this, because I sort of forgot whether like how she was in this, but I think she does a really great job in this as well. And I think that it's really just Keanu that kind of sticks out like a sore thumb. Like he seems like the guy who's, you know, he has a little bit of high school theater experience, and he just goes at it, and it just it's kind of he's just kind of silly in this. But
you've got to be meeting what's going on here, and there's just so much going on here.
But otherwise, I think it was a blast to revisit this. It's a very, you know, like sort of a theme, I think, with the movies that we're going to be talking about this month, is that it felt very epic. I think all of the movies, actually, that we're talking about this month feel very epic. They're all very large in scope. I don't know. Are they all over 2 hours? I think all of them are at or above 2 hours. I had a good time revisiting this, and I would definitely recommend it. Unfortunately, missed opportunity that it came out several years before the classic Rob Zombie song, Dracula.
Yes.
Because
you have been Yes.
They could have used this in the end credits. Oh man, that would have put it over the top for me. You put in Dracula in the end credits of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Oh,
5 stars.
10 out of 10.
Yeah, you have been sending me so many. Every time there's a shockingly high number of like Dracula centric memes on Twitter, and you've been sending me them all, and I appreciate it so much.
Won't be the last time we talk about that song. I guarantee it.
It is that song really is in a way a gift that really does keep on giving.
Yeah, 100%.
Good song.
Any fun thoughts on Dracula before we move on?
No. Now I have Dracula in my head now, which is hardly a bad place to be.
No, there's a lot. There's many, many worse songs that you could have stuck in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we have another vampire movie. This time, a more contemporary adaptation from author Anne Rice, directed by Neil Jordan, and released on November 11th, 1994. This is Interview with the Vampire.
You're a vampire. You never knew what life was until it ran out in a red gush over your lips.
They live for the pleasure, the passion, the thrill.
The story you told me is incredible. It's amazing.
And they will live forever.
Don't make me do this. I cannot!
Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt. Interview with the Vampire. Rated R. Starts Friday, November 11th at a theater near you.
A vampire relates his epic life story of love, betrayal, loneliness, and dark hunger to an over-curious reporter. Now, continuing our theme with movies that are just so much,
yeah.
We arrive here. I say this in a very complimentary way. This movie is just so much. This movie is just so intentionally just, there's so much. It's just beautiful garbage.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, I don't know how long the book is. I haven't read the book. My stepmom was really into Anne Rice. Like, she had all the books and stuff, and I never read any of Anne Rice's novels or anything, but I can only imagine, just judging from this movie, that the book must be like 2,000 pages long. That is the only thing I can come up with, because this movie is... It is so much. There is just so much going on in this movie. And unfortunately, I've seen this movie multiple times, and this time around, I was so bored. I was just bored out of my skull watching this. And I think maybe because I've seen it like maybe two other times throughout my life, and I guess it was just, I was at my limit, and I was just like, nah, I can't. This is too much. This movie's too much. There's certainly elements of it that I still like. Pretty much everything with Kirsten Dunst in this. She's in this as a very young actor, and I think that she does a really good job in it. Mm-hmm. I kind of forgot how goofy Tom Cruise was in this. Like, he's kind of a goofball in it.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, so I'll start by saying this is the first time I've seen this movie. I did not really know what this movie was. I don't really understand what it was until I watched it. And yes, it does feel longer than 2 hours, but that was good because it gave me a chance to just take it all in completely gobsmacked for the first time. Because, I mean, it's Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, you know, going around and biting people and trying to set each other on fire. So I had never known that before, and now that I know it, I like knowing that it's there.
It's kind of funny because a lot of this movie is just two dudes taking care of their daughter. They're just
it's a parenting narrative.
Yeah, they're just living life. It's like My Two Dads. They're just they're just trying to keep control of their unruly daughter who wants to eat everyone she sees, which, by the way, I think that's probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is that montage where she's just destroying, she's killing everyone, like the piano teacher and the doll maker.
In a way, this is a sitcom.
It is.
It's a great sitcom.
And I think that that's something that, should be noted, is the level of kind of dark humor in this movie. I think that maybe, or at least I kind of forgot about the humor in this, and there's plenty of kind of goofy moments.
Mm-hmm. And it's so odd because it is like, because you don't realize that at the start, because it really just kind of settles into it. Because at the start, it just feels like this disjointed, deadly, serious movie about just an inherently ridiculous premise. And at the start, I was kind of worried, but once it gets into it.
The whole, like, bookends, that whole mm-hmm. thing with Christian Slater, like, it feels so pointless. Like, why does it? I mean, I could almost guarantee it makes a lot more sense within the context of the book. But in the movie version, it feels so inconsequential. Like, what is the point of this? They put that scene in at the end, the little stinger there, and it's just like, ugh, come on. Give me a break. So what are we led to believe that Tom Cruise was just like hanging out in the back of this guy's car the whole time while he let Brad Pitt tell this story? Like, none of it makes sense. There's so much in this movie that makes no sense whatsoever. Like, so many just logic questions that I have. Like, one thing that really bothered me, this is something so dumb, but I couldn't get over it, is when they go to Paris and they're on the Mediterranean and they're arriving to this port, and they cut to Kirsten Dunst on the ship, the deck of the ship, and she has this like charcoal painting that is almost completely done. It's this giant canvas with this really detailed charcoal painting of the port that they're currently floating into. And it's like, how the hell did she have time to finish this charcoal painting? I couldn't get over it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so, there's just so many little things like that where you're just like, what? That doesn't really. I was also wondering, like, so Kirsten Dunst is a child when she gets turned into a vampire. So Brad Pitt's character bites her, and then they, rather than killing her, I guess they let her become a vampire as well, and they decide to raise her. So my question is, does her, because a child's brain isn't fully developed. So I'm wondering, it's more of like a nature versus nurture question. Like, mm-hmm. as the years go on, because we're with her for like, I don't know, over a decade. So like, mm-hmm. by the time she dies in the film, she's probably like 30, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But she still kind of acts like a kid. So my quandary here is, because she was turned into a vampire as a child, does that mean that her, like, mental capacity is that of a child? Does she stay a child, or as she continues to get older, should she be more acting like an adult? Because I've seen it happen both ways in vampire stories, where, mm-hmm. you know, you have a child character who's, like, 500 years old, and he's, like, you know, wise, like one of the wisest people on the planet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think? How do you think that would play out?
I think there would be, I think there probably would be, like, there would be poor behavioral or decision-making skills, but at the same time, yeah, you would have the knowledge and memory base of however many years she would have been on the earth in total. So I don't know. I think it would just be, I mean, we're trying to imply conventional, like, our layperson understandings of like human psychological development to a fictional vampire child. So maybe it's just in another category altogether. She is at once all vampire, all the human child, and all the some other like non-human entity altogether.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'll accept that. I'll accept that.
Yes, I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. She is probably every possible answer at once.
Comparing this to like the visual aspect of this to Dracula, I don't even think that they're in the same realm. Like, I think that this movie is largely, it doesn't look cheap, but
it's almost washed out sometimes, though.
I get that feeling. Like, the camera work's not very good. There's a scene, of course, with a vampire movie, you have to have a scene where somebody's crawling on the ceiling. And when they do it in this movie, it looks really bad. Like, you can clearly tell that the whole room is rotating because the camera is, like, shaking like crazy. Like, they needed to WD-40 those ball bearings or whatever that they were using to spin that room, because it looked really bad. Although, that does remind me of a really great-looking scene, is when they did a rotating room scene and someone was on fire as they were crawling up the wall and onto the ceiling. And
that's a good scene.
That looked really impressive. In fact, there's multiple scenes where people are on fire in this movie, and it all looked really quite good.
The scenes in which the effects are very good make the scenes in which the effects are not very good very much stand out.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, the firework, like the pyrotechnics and stuff in this, it was all on point. I mean, whatever crew they got to do the fire stuff in this, it was incredible. Everything else,
which is good because it's almost like a sub. It's almost a recurring plot. Fire is a subplot of this movie. Fire is a supporting character.
Yeah, a lot of fire. Everything else looked pretty bad. Most of the makeup work and all of that was really bad. Like how they had like the veiny faces and stuff. It didn't look real. It looked like it was kind of painted, like airbrushed on, and any of the scenes involving people getting cut up and stuff, just I don't know, just none of it looked particularly good, which is funny again comparing it to Dracula, where you have really good effects work. This movie came out, you know, what, 2 years later, and it doesn't even come close to being on the same level of quality as that one, as Dracula.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think it's just a really, I think the way that this movie is put together is just kind of odd in a sense, because that is the thing. You know, we talked about the kind of the sloppy nature of the framing device, and it is kind of an odd thing where in some ways this movie does feel so like a fully developed, like it does feel novelistic in a way, and in other ways it just really does feel kind of just slapdash. And I don't know, I was reading an interesting thing about Anne Rice, because she wrote the screenplay adaptation, which is not a thing that, you know, the average author of a film adaptation gets to do unless they are quite successful already. And she was kind of, she definitely had a lot of reservations about it. Like, there's this thing, you know, where she almost rewrote the Brad Pitt part to be played by, like, Cher, like a male-female dynamic, because she was worried that, like, there's a kind of a key queer undertone or subtext to the plot, and apparently it's more apparent in the novel, and she was worried that, like, the mainstream Hollywood wouldn't go for it, so she thought about rewriting that. And even when she felt like she was able to have both of the lead characters be male, she was very troubled when they cast Tom Cruise in the role. Like, apparently the point where she, like, just almost, like, dropped off the entire project. She put out a public statement stating her, like, disapproval that they would cast Cruise in the performance, and then she retracted her public statement of disowning when she saw it and actually liked it and thought he was good in it.
As far as the adaptation goes, and again, I haven't read the novel. I don't know if it stays very, you know, close to the novel, but it felt like one of those movie adaptations that was very apparent. You know, sometimes when you see a novel to movie adaptation, like, they feel pretty lazy, like where they have like the narration and it just feels like, okay, yeah, this was clearly a book. And that's sort of the way it felt for me. It was like, okay, this is very obviously based on a book. I would be able to easily guess that without knowing it beforehand. And I sound like I'm really being really hard on this movie, but I still kind of like it overall.
I think once the movie really does get into the dynamic of just in like the thick of its plot, then it is actually a very impressive feeling movie that even without having read the novel, you do really get kind of a, in a good way, a novelistic feeling, because the characters feel kind of developed. I'd say Rice's concerns about not being able to really translate like a possible like queer reading of the story between those characters, I don't think that's really a concern, because I feel like that part of the narrative, if that's intended, does remain intact in like a way that is as good as a major studio production in 1994 could be about it. And it does feel like a kind of a really interestingly adapted movie without having read the source material. So I don't know why, what I think a good adaptation is when I use that qualifier. It's just the everything outside of its like just most insular scenes that are just in like the middle of developing these characters that the movie kind of just feels jagged. And to the level that like what's good works so much, and there's just this strange cozy feeling to it, for lack of a better word, like this strange, like you can kind of sink into this movie's world to the point where it's like it's enjoyable. I recommend it. I mean, I'm gonna come out on the other side of this recommending it, but yeah, there's just so many different odd feelings about the way this movie was put together, but you kind of just have to admire just how much is going on in it for a movie that is trying so many things, and it doesn't terribly work all the time, but when it works, it kind of really does feel like a very interesting, like huge swing at every possible idea that it could have. And I kind of admire that.
Yeah. I think this is one of these movies that, you know, if you're looking for something to watch on a lazy Sunday afternoon, you pop on Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles, and I think you'll have a good time with it. If they tightened it up, I think if they removed some of the whole like parenting stuff with Kirsten Dunst, where there's a large chunk in there where it felt like there really wasn't much movement in the plot. And I think that if maybe they trimmed that up or maybe restructured it a little bit, it would have felt, I think the pacing would have worked better. And then like also, the whole, like, the Interview with the Vampire, colon, The Vampire Chronicles, I swear that that was not like that originally. And when I was going back and watching trailers for this in preparation for the episode, it says The Vampire Chronicles in those teaser trailers. They don't say it out loud, but it's definitely a subtitle there. So I feel like there might be some kind of Mandela effect thing happening with this. Because I swear that there was never a like subtitle to this movie.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a weird thing with the title, though, because I'm looking at the Wikipedia article, which has like the original theatrical poster with like the billing block on it and all the additional text. Yeah, and it says Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles. But if I pull up the Letterboxd page, it just says Interview with the Vampire, and it's a poster without the billing block.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that I'm misremembering it, but I just thought that was kind of an odd thing. I do not remember that the Vampire Chronicles portion of it being there.
The IMDb says Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I believe that that's what it was. I mean, the trailers had it, so, and those were like the original trailers, like the TV spots. From back in 94, so there's evidence, but man, it's one of those weird things. Antonio Banderas is in this. He plays another vampire. So they go to Paris and they end up finding Antonio Banderas in another, I guess you'd call him a coven of vampires. And the scene when Brad Pitt first meets the other vampire, and they have that really strange interaction underneath that like bridge. I thought that was the funniest scene, because first of all, Brad Pitt looks like a magician. Like he looks like he's just straight up wearing a magician's costume. And then they have this like really strange interaction where they're like mimicking each other and stuff. And then the thing that I thought was odd was that at one point, Antonio Banderas was like, you got to get out of here. Like, you got to leave. They're going to kill her because in this world, it's forbidden to make a child a vampire. So they were going to kill her and presumably kill them. Or what they ended up doing was they were going to, like, put Brad Pitt in a box for forever. And, like, why wouldn't you just leave? Like, just, there's really not that much for you there to begin with. I mean, just go. Just get out of there. But he doesn't listen.
But there's more movie left.
He doesn't listen, and then, you know, just bad things happen. They kill, they end up killing Kirsten Dunst. A really powerful scene.
Yeah.
I give it a light recommend overall.
I think you should you should have to watch this once. I think everyone should get to watch this once.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth at least one look.
You need to know that this movie exists. Like, I'm not surprised that it does that. You're saying it's not really holding up on a rewatch for you. I can't imagine watching this again because I feel like it would fall apart. But this first time, I was just overwhelmed by it.
Well. One thing that I did watch for the first time was Queen.
You mentioned this.
I got to mention Queen of the Damned because this is a sort of sequel to Interview with the Vampire. It is based on an Anne Rice novel and part of the Vampire Chronicles series. Although the thing that kind of bothers me about this is that it's not called Queen of the Damned: The Vampire Chronicles. It's just called Queen of the Damned. Come on, guys.
Yeah,
get with it.
It's kind of, you have to be like, you know, when they would adapt the YA novels and every subsequent one had to have like the title of the franchise at the start, I guess, so you could all rent them all at once on a VOD or something.
So
this
movie, it came out in 2002, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much in this podcast. We're a 90s podcast, but I will say that it feels like a very 90s movie. It feels incredibly 90s. So the premise of this, okay, so you have Stuart Townsend in there as Lestat. So you have Lestat waking up like 100 years later. He puts himself into some kind of deep sleep or whatever, and he wakes up 100 years later, and it's presumably 2002. And the thing that wakes him up is there's a new metal band playing in his house. So his house is like abandoned. This band goes in is practicing in his house. The sultry sounds of nu metal wake him up, and he's just like, what is this? This is incredible. So he goes in and he checks it out, and he realizes that nu metal is they're the new gods. So he decides that he wants to be the singer of a new metal band. and remember, like, the whole time I'm watching this, because I watched them back to back, and the whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, this is Tom Cruise's character from this other movie. And he's like wearing the tight leather, and I'm pretty sure, and I haven't looked this up because I don't actually care too much, but I'm pretty sure that all of the songs that he played were actually sung by the guy from Korn. So if you're familiar with the music of Korn, you have a really good idea of what kind of music Lestat is playing. So imagine Lestat in Interview with the Vampire being in Korn, because that's what this movie is.
And once you told me about this, I desperately wanted to watch it before the podcast so I'd talk about it too, but I did not find the time.
So the whole premise is that Lestat instantly becomes a rock star. I mean, there's like no time, like he is just bam, famous. And he does like a press conference because he's going to announce this big outdoor concert, and he's asking all the other vampires to come to this thing. And the one of the journalists asks him, she goes, "The one thing I know about vampires is that they keep their identity a secret. Is that kind of bother the other vampires?" And I'm like, that's the one thing you know about vampires? Like, Not like the drinking of the blood or the daylight or anything like that. You know what? You know what I've always wanted to know? What's going to happen if you tell everybody? And I was just like, what the hell?
Yeah, you can't tell. I don't know. It's almost like being a magician. You can't tell anyone the tricks.
Interestingly, the guy from Korn, I don't know the lead singer's name, but he actually has a cameo in this too. Aaliyah is famously in this as well. She plays the titular role of the Queen of the Damned. So it turns out that she's like the first vampire. She's like the original one. And she gets awoken somehow and like decides that she wants to rule over all of the humans. And she kind of seduces Lestat and he follows her for a minute, but then betrays her. And when he realizes that she's like pretty evil, and Aaliyah's really good in this.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I think, probably one of the only roles that she was in as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Romeo Must Die. And is that the only other one that, yeah, I think it might've been.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was in Romeo Must Die and then this, and she was really good. She was really good in this.
I've heard that she's really good in this. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really surprised. But yeah, she was really good in this. And, the movie's ridiculous. I mean, it is just utterly, utterly ridiculous in every way. And I highly recommend it.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those movies that when it came out, I had heard it was like just so awful. And I was just like, nah, I'm not going to bother with that one. So I just never saw it. And over the years, I heard people sort of speaking fondly of it. And but it still never really got me to watch it. And then finally I was like, okay, I have an excuse to watch this movie now.
Yeah, I'm okay. So I'm on the, I just went on the Wikipedia page for Queen of the Damned. And there was something about like how apparently this, like another, you know, Vampire Chronicles movie after Interview with the Vampire took a long time to develop. And Anne Rice was in 1998. I'm just going to, there's no actual substance. I haven't read through this whole response, but I just need to say the key factor here that she begins by writing. The key factor here is that the entire vampire contract terminates in the year 2000. And then she goes on to say all the properties revert to me at that time, unless production commences. I just caught the line, the key factors that the vampire contract terminates in 2000. And I thought that she was like talking about something in the story. I thought like, does the Vampire Chronicles series end because their contracts expire as vampires? I was like scrolling past that night, that sentence jumped out to me and I was really shocked by it because I thought Anne Rice wrote in like a legal thriller element to the Vampire Chronicles series.
Oh my God.
But no, it was just about rights.
Yeah, check out Queen of the Damned if you're looking for.
If you're looking
for a good laugh, it is just
new metal.
It's so over the top, and what a soundtrack! And just everything about it is just so utterly ridiculous all the time. That
I don't know if regular listeners have picked this out, but we kind of have recurring discussion points on this show, including badly written synopses and new metal. So,
oh yeah, new metal will, oh yeah, always, yeah, and forever be mentioned. In fact, we could mention it for our next movie. Actually,
it's kind of hard to talk about. It's kind of hard to have a podcast where you review 90s movies and not bring it up a lot.
Puppy Surprise is having puppies.
How many?
That's the surprise.
Surprise!
Puppy Surprise.
How many puppies are there inside?
Three puppies.
And they're all different.
Surprise!
Puppy Surprise.
Four puppies.
How many puppies are there inside?
There could be three or four or five.
Five! I can't believe my eyes.
Surprise, surprise with Puppy Surprise.
Puppy Surprise comes with three, four, or five baby puppies. One in five mommy dogs comes with four or five puppies. Each sold separately.
Our third feature this month is a reimagining of the classic play by William Shakespeare, coming out on November 1st, 1996, and directed by the one and only Baz Luhrmann. This is Romeo and, with a plus sign, Juliet.
Art fools, you know not what you do!
Romeo! Thou art a villain!
My only love sprung from my only hate.
Romeo, Lucibus! Romeo!
Leonardo DiCaprio, Claire Danes, in William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
I am fortune's fool!
Rated PG-13.
In director Baz Luhrmann's contemporary take on William Shakespeare's classic tragedy, the Montagues and Capulets have moved their ongoing feud to the sweltering suburb of Verona Beach, where Romeo and Juliet fall in love and secretly wed. Though the film is visually modern, the bard's dialogue remains. All right, Ken, what do you think about Romeo plus Juliet?
I love this movie. It's fantastic. I love how much it is, returning that point. I love that they just like try and tweak everything, like even down to the title. It can't be an and, it has to be the little plus sign. I love the soundtrack. I love the production design. I love that in accordance with the, you know, famous opening sonnet, the 2 hours traffic of our stages movie is exactly 2 hours down to the minute. It's great. It's like, I think my favorite Baz Luhrmann. Good performances. Great movie. It's one of those movies. It's one of those movies in my like rotation that I'll just like put on. I've seen it a lot. It's fairly good.
You know, I just was never a fan of this movie. I'm still not. I was actually, out of all the movies that we're covering this month, this was the one where I was just like, oh, I don't want to revisit this. And I watched this in high school, actually. We watched this, and maybe it was middle school. Nah, it was probably high school. I remember I did like a whole thing on Romeo and Juliet where we read it and like looked at all of the meaning behind it, like the names and stuff, and it was just awful. Like I don't like the story. I'm so cynical when it comes to this story and pretty much all of Shakespeare's stuff. Like, I'm not a fan of Shakespeare in general. Mm-hmm. I don't like the like Shakespearean language, and I think that that's a huge, huge barrier in this movie.
Yeah,
because it's
I kind of like Shakespeare.
I'm not into that. And I mean, one thing that I will say is that it's clever. Like the mm-hmm. idea behind this, like of making this modern Shakespearean adaptation and retaining the language. And it, one of the things that I did, because I really didn't want to revisit this movie, but in order to sort of make myself feel better about it, I actually followed along with the actual play. So as I was watching the movie, I had the play open and I was following along, and you know, it really, like, it's almost word for word. Like, they did a really, mm-hmm. really good job of adapting mm-hmm. the play. There were, like, very minor changes, but most of the dialogue is the exact same. I was impressed with that. And I thought, mm-hmm. I thought that that's what it was, but I never confirmed that. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, it was kind of fun to read along with Romeo and Juliet.
That could be fun. I also first encountered this movie, like watched it for the first time in high school when I was like, I think it was my freshman year English class, where we also did the same thing, went through the play and then ended by watching this adaptation. And I guess just in the nature of trying to watch a movie in school, like broken into segments across different days in a less than ideal setting, you don't really react much to any movie, or at least I don't. But I kind of like was intrigued by just this entire idea. And then when I was able to like rewatch it at a later point, just start to finish, I was like, oh yeah, no, that this is great. This is like, yeah. And then it's just kind of become like, it's in that, like, I don't own a lot of movies for, but like on physical media, and for the ones I do, you know, I don't rewatch things a terrible amount, but this is like, on like the level of like a couple other things I own, like, you know, like Airplane or Mean Girls or something, where it's like, no, I can just rewatch this.
I feel like this movie straddles the line between being completely brilliant and being completely just batshit insane. Like,
why does it have to be one or the other?
Well, I mean, I think that it is insane, but I think that the concept is something that I think it's either going to really work and be something kind of special and unique, or it's going to be an absolute failure on every level. And I think that, you know, for what it is, I think that it does succeed. I think that it is something unique. And I mean, visually, you know, we all know that, Baz Luhrmann is a very visual storyteller, and this movie is a great example of that. Like the world building is something that I can really, you know, speak to positively in this movie. I loved the world building. Like, I would love to see another movie take place at Verona yes. Beach, you know, and because yep. I loved all the sets, like all the set design in this movie is just out of control, and the costuming too. Like, it's just all so yeah. good.
And just the cinematography, just the color palette of this movie, just the way that it just pops.
Over, like, super, everything's so saturated and just bright and like drenched in sunlight. And I loved all of that. I really did. It's just a shame that like the dialogue I found to be so laughable at times, and the juxtaposition between, you know, the modern stuff with the old language.
I think that's kind of intentional, though. Like,
of course, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it is. It's very intentionally silly. I mean, the fact that you have that, you know, they call their guns their swords, and then like the type of sword is written on the side of the gun. Like, come on, that's definitely that is definitely on the nose. That is definitely this movie doesn't take. I don't think it takes itself too seriously or anything like that. So, I don't know. I do find it to be a little bit inconsistent at times with its tone.
I mean, it is. Yeah, it's just packed full of, like, you know, little Shakespeare in jokes just on like the set dressing or the billboards, just that, you know, whatever you see. It's it is. It's something that
I forgot about the crazy speed ramping in this, where like what. What was that all about? Where they would just randomly speed stuff up? I'm like, what? It's such a '90s thing where you have like the fast forward stuff going on, like completely unnecessarily speeding things up. I don't know about this movie. It's just I think that this is another movie that is absolutely worth watching at least once, but. If you're not into Shakespeare, I think that you're going to have a hard time with it.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. I think you also have to just be inherently open to the idea. Well, I just think you have to like be inherently like really receptive to the idea of this movie going in, like, because it is just such an on its face ridiculous idea. But you have to be, you have to contribute that. Yes, I would like to see what this looks like. Finally, someone's doing this. And once you're in, you're locked in. And I think another thing that I really kind of admire about it is just retroactively to think this movie did not have a terribly high budget. I mean, it looks more expensive than it was. Apparently it was under $15 million. Yeah, it was
like 14 something.
Yeah. But I mean, it wouldn't have been a terrible, like, this would have been before, you know, this was DiCaprio right before Titanic. So it wasn't like he was commanding huge numbers. So yeah, I mean, I guess most of that money would be, you know, on the screen. And you couldn't even imagine, like, this is something you have to talk about. It kind of comes up all the time if you're ever talking about 90s movies compared to like the way like Hollywood filmmaking was, at least, you know, before in 2019, let's just say before March 2020. And you could say you could not imagine the Hollywood of like 2019, like any major studio saying, getting this pitch and being like, yes, make it, we're gonna put it on 2500 screens.
Well, you know what? I mean, it worked out for him. It made a ton of money.
Yeah.
And I
mean, $152 million. Dollars.
Leonardo DiCaprio was already kind of a heartthrob when this movie came out. So I think that his presence did definitely help with that. And then, of course, Claire Danes was also pretty popular with the teen crowd at this point, because this was post My So-Called Life, which was, even though that show was only on for like one season, I think that it was tremendously popular. So you have these kind of really big you know, teen stars in this movie doing this iconic love story. So on top of that, you also have this very contemporary setting with like action and guns, and you have that soundtrack. I mean, I think that this is
Talk about the soundtrack.
I think that this is another movie where the soundtrack is one of the things that really propelled it into sort of the crazy success that it had. I mean, especially that cardigan song, Loveful, like that, mm-hmm. that song was huge. Oh my God. That song was just,
what a song it is.
Over playing that song over and over and over again. Got Butthole Surfers in there too. Cause mm-hmm. you gotta have Butthole Surfers in a 90s apparently. Soundtrack. Gotta have them in there. Everclear, Garbage. Oh boy. Yeah.
There's the, I like the soundtrack. I like the love theme. I like that song, Kissing You. I like that song. I like the soundtrack. It fits well. And then of course it ends with, the Radiohead song.
Mm-hmm. Paul Rudd's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to forget. I think it's easy to forget that Paul Rudd is in Romeo and Juliet, and there's a scene where he's dressed up as a spaceman and he's dancing. So
the Halloween party scene. What a great sequence. What a wonderful realization. What a wonderful adaptation of that moment.
I still roll my eyes every time there's the scene, the aquarium scene. Like I roll my eyes so hard. roll my eyes so hard it hurts during that scene.
I love it. I love it.
The dude from Hackers is in this too.
Mm.
You have John Leguizamo in there as Tybalt. Good mm-hmm. casting on that. I like mm-hmm. he was really good in this. Completely hamming it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought everybody like performance wise did a pretty good job. Like,
oh yeah.
No complaints there from me. I think it's interesting that in this movie, Leonardo DiCaprio has wet hair the whole time. Like his hair is just wet all the time in this movie. It's like they come up with an excuse to make his hair wet because they're like, you know what? He's like 10 times sexier when he has wet hair. So mm-hmm. let's just drench him in water constantly. Mm-hmm. Keep that hair wet. As soon as it starts mm-hmm. to dry, you got to dump him. Put him in a pool, put him in the rain, do something, but just get that hair wet.
I'm just having such a good time talking about this movie. Yeah, I can't. That was the thing, is I went into this loving this movie, wanting to talk about it, and also not knowing how to say why I like it so much. Like, that you don't particularly like it, I can't adequately explain why I like it to you. It's just, I haven't examined my feelings about it that closely enough for some way, which is weird since I've seen it multiple times. I can't adequately explain it. I don't know. Maybe it is just one of those things you just have to. I mean, this applies to everything. You just really just have to have a predisposition towards the idea of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I was hoping that it was going to be one of those movies that Because I probably haven't watched this since I saw it in high school. I was kind of hoping that maybe watching it now, I'd have like a newer appreciation for it or something. And unfortunately, it didn't. I didn't like actively hate my time with it or anything. Far from it, actually. As I said at the top of this review, I was kind of dreading going back to this. But I did enjoy myself for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like the beginning parts when it starts to get into the ridiculous, unbelievable love story and the poisoning and all of that. I was just like, ugh, come on. I just feel like it, you know, like Shakespeare deals with like kind of universal themes and stories and stuff like that. But when you get down to like the specifics of his stories, they just don't hold up. To modern day, like I'm sitting here like Juliet's supposed to be like 13, right? She's supposed to be like 13. She's a 13 year old child, or I'm supposed to sit here and believe that she sees this dude, instantly falls in love, they get married like the next day, and then she kills herself when he kills himself. Like, I just I think I just have a really hard time with that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, yes, if you... That's the thing about trying to read this story on its face, is that the story on its face is not terribly appealing or worth one's while. But yeah, I think that's the whole thing about like reading Shakespeare, is that you have to read through it. And it's, and Romeo and Juliet is not a play that I've ever had any particular connection to. Like, from, I haven't read a terrible amount of Shakespeare, but from what I have, it's not one that I think about really all that much. I feel like people should really teach the Shakespeare sonnets more. Like, you try to get everyone on these plays. These could be very long, very complex plays, but it's hard. I mean, the sonnets. I love some of the sonnets. I'm reading your tone as someone who had to read these things in high school and hasn't thought about them since.
And maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's that I was forced to read all of this Shakespeare in high school and deconstruct it and like live these stories for, you know, a semester or however long it was. And like, I just couldn't stand it. And it just soured me on all of his stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's been interesting discussion just about Shakespeare, like in like scholarly discussion that I've looked at recently. Like, actually the Taming of the Shrew comes up a lot, of people wondering whether like it's one of those Shakespeare plays that the politics are just irredeemably prejudiced in it. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Shakespeare, is that because he is just so in the canon, just defines that idea of just like a writer that everybody has to read is, if they want to read English literature, it's that it will never go away. There will always be more ways to talk about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Which, much to the chagrin of, you know, a lot of people who are being taught it in school, probably in not terribly engaging ways.
Our final film this month is based on a Vanity Fair article by Marie Brenner, a journalist who would also have two more of her pieces adapted into movies, A Private War and Richard Jewell. Richard Jewell. directed by Michael Mann and released on November 5th, 1999. This is The Insider.
Only one motion picture has been rousing, uplifting, and stirring critics all across America. Al Pacino, Russell Crowe, in the best film of the year. The Insider, a Michael Mann film, rated R, now playing.
Okay, we've got another great, beautifully worded synopsis here. Tells the true story of a 60 Minutes television series expose of the tobacco industry, as seen through the eyes of a real tobacco executive, Jeffrey Wigand. This is a brilliant 157-minute movie. There's so much going on with it. It is firing all cylinders. It is like great Michael Mann filmmaking with great performances, and that's the best that whoever wrote that synopsis can muster.
Yeah.
Tells the true story. It starts as is that a sentence fragment, basically?
Yeah, it is. It is. The true story? Come on.
Tells the true story. There's no subject. It tells the truth. It starts with the verb.
What a great movie, though. Yeah.
It is a fantastic
movie. I don't think that I ever saw this before. I remember when it came out, I wasn't really interested in it at the time. And when I was watching it for this podcast, I just didn't remember anything about it. And as I was watching it, I'm like, I would remember this. Like, I would absolutely remember like these performances and just this movie in general. So I think that this was a first time watch for me. I don't know when I would have seen it previously. So this was a real treat for me. As you said, it is sort of an epic, a lot going on in this movie. It covers a lot of information, covers a lot of ground, and it just feels like this is, I think that this could go on to become a classic. Like, it is such a high caliber production that you see it and you almost think like, man, they just don't make movies like this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another movie that you can't really imagine being made, or at least in the same way that it was made, like, if this, you know, pitch came around today. Yeah, I don't know how Michael Mann is exactly talked about, but it feels like this really isn't like, you know, you get the movies that are kind of referenced in the same breath, like, you know, Thief and Heat, but really The Insider feels like it's the one you think about after people think about after a second or two, like after they've thought about the other ones. But I'm look at it. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, what you have here is you have Russell Crowe and Al Pacino at the peak performance. I mean, these two guys acting opposite one another, they're two phenomenal actors at the absolute top of their game. I mean, they just both turn out such incredible performances in this. Like, you're just riveted the whole time. And it's when you look at what this is, I mean, it's not a movie that's like chock full of action or anything like that. It's about, you know, Russell Crowe plays a former chemist for a tobacco company who decides to breach his NDA and leak, essentially become a whistleblower to 60 Minutes. And Al Pacino plays a producer on 60 Minutes. But oh my God, is it just, and you would think like, could they sustain something like that, which on the surface seems like it might be a little bit dry. Can they sustain that for over 2.5 hours? And the answer is yes, they absolutely do. Yeah. Like that it's the runtime of this movie just absolutely flies by. You do not feel the runtime in this whatsoever because you're just so captivated by what's going on in this really compelling story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's because I think that's what helps it is that it operates on so many different levels and trying to examine these characters and their dynamics, that it's not just about the idea of the whistleblower. It is just so much internally about like how this would come together and all the different forces pressing on these characters, and also an examination of the characters themselves. Yeah, that is just able to get in at every level of it, I think, is what really sustains it.
Yeah, I recommend this highly, highly recommend this movie. This was definitely the highlight of this month for me, especially because I believe that this was the first time I've seen this movie, and I just had such a great time with it. I like Michael Mann's movies. I like some of his movies, I should say. He's looking at his filmography, it's like maybe 50-50 for me. Mm-hmm. But I actually watched Thief for the first time this week as well, and I freaking loved Thief. Holy crap. Like, I knew that I was going to love that movie, but for whatever reason, like, it just eluded me for years and years. And then when I watched The Insider for the show, I was like, okay, this is a good excuse for me to just sit down and watch Thief, and I absolutely freaking loved it. Like, it's like an almost a 10 out of 10 for me. And of course, Heat is like, you know, that's like everybody's, it's like on everybody's top 10. I mean, wow, Heat is 2 hours and 50 minutes long.
It is 170 minutes.
Did not know that it was that long. That's another movie that just flies by. I've been meaning to rewatch Heat for a long time. I've really loved that movie.
Meaning to get more heat.
Yeah.
Get heated up again. I don't know.
Raise that temperature a bit.
Yeah. I haven't seen a ton of Michael Mann. I love The Insider, love Heat. I really like Miami Vice. I know that's a bit of a more divisive one, and even like, I don't know. I need to go through the whole filmography to think of, am I just a Michael Mann person, or do I just like the ones I've seen? Device that I'm more divided on the other ones, but I don't know. Even like Black Hat, I don't know how many people liked Black Hat. That was very divisive.
I think Black Hat had its moments. There were elements of it that I liked. I think that Michael Mann has this weird, or he did this weird thing within the last couple, I guess, he did it with Public Enemies too, where he shoots it on digital and it looks really bad. Like, he tries to make, like, with Black Hat and Public Enemies, it, like,
And Miami Vice. Miami Vice is a shot on digital.
Is it? I didn't remember that one, but
there are moments where it like becomes part of the movie to think about the fact that it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't remember. I know that what enough, you mean. But to me, like a Public Enemy is just really egregious of it, where it almost looks like a soap opera, where it's like the frame rate is not quite right,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, that's what I meant when I said that, because it's like, yeah, that's the thing with like. As far as Miami Vice, I haven't seen Public Enemies, but as far as Miami Vice is concerned, it's like nature of it. It's like it's so hard to not think about it in every element of it.
I think it's more. It's just more noticeable in Public Enemies because it's a period piece, and you're just like, mm-hmm. this doesn't look right. Why does it look like that? Why is the it's like the lighting is soft and everything just looks a little too clean and smooth, and you're just like, I don't like this. I remember Black Hat being similar to that too, where it was almost like it was the frame rate is too high. It looks like things are moving too fluidly or something, and you're just like, ugh.
Yeah.
Motion smoothing is turned on the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, but still, you look at a Michael Mann movie, and even when the digital video looks the most jarring, and I would agree with you at times, it just doesn't look good at all, you can't help but look at every image and think, that is exactly what he wanted it to look like. And you don't sometimes you don't understand why, but you're like, I am fully confident. One thing I love about Michael Mann is that none of his movies feel like any other movies. They always feel very much of one of like an of an artist's particular approach. But it's like you look at it and it's like all this I can in this moment I can only take solace in the fact that this is definitely what he was going for.
Yeah, I mean I think The Insider looks great though. I mean like
oh yeah,
that's shot on beautiful 35mm and it just looks, you know, it has that sort of. I don't know how to really describe
hints to it. Like yeah. It's got these so many shots of these, like these gorgeous like you know like thick deep blue tints and it's yeah.
There's also like a graininess to it that I like that sort of evokes this you know like Woodward and Bernstein like classic. Classic political thriller vibe that I really love, and yeah, it just I think that visually it looks really good. And I think Ali also had a little bit of that same vibe to it. I think Ali looked really good as well, which was what he directed directly after The Insider. I remember Last of the Mohicans when that movie came out. It was like the big talked about movie. Everybody's talking about The Last of the Mohicans. And I remember that was one of those movies that came on a double VHS. So there were two VHS tapes that came with it. And when my parents rented it, it was the letterboxed version of the movie. And I think it was the first time that I ever saw a movie in letterboxed. Because at that point, you know, TVs are 4x3, they're square essentially, and everything that you watched back then was pan and scan or just you know cropped to a 4x3. So it filled the whole screen. So when I first saw The Last of the Mohicans as a little kid, I was just like, what is going on here? Like, why is the movie chopped off like that? Why are these big black bars on the screen? And it really bothered me as a child. I think that the bigger issue there is that I was like 9 years old and watching Last of the Mohicans. Like that's not a movie that you could put a 9 year old in front of.
Does not play to the 9 year old demographic does it?
Yeah. And have them be like, you know, glued to the screen with Last of the Mohicans. I don't think I've seen it since then, honestly. Like just the whole experience was so awful. I was so bored by it, and I couldn't stop looking at the black bars. I should rewatch that. I bet I'd really like it now.
Yeah, That's the only thing I could say is that with someone who's like only very slowly working their way through Michael Mann, every Michael Mann movie that I watch makes me want to watch another one, because it's like, you understand, like, it is just such a thing where you're like, there's more like this. There's more movies like this.
have you seen Collateral?
I have not. That'll be next.
Because that's another one of his very, very wildly popular ones, which I liked. I like Collateral. I don't think that I was as wild about it as a lot of other people, but like to me, The Insider is a better movie than Collateral, but I still like Collateral quite a bit.
I watched in such a weird order. I think the first one I watched was Thief, and the second one I watched was Black Hat.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying. It's like, I didn't like start with like, well, I gotta go to Heat, gotta go to Thief, gotta go to the Insider. I've just been going all around in circles.
That's what I like to do. A lot of times I like to start with the more obscure things or the older things. And I don't like to necessarily go in order of popularity or reverse mm-hmm. chronological order or anything like that. I just kind of go random. Whatever I'm feeling. Yeah,
I just run into a problem if I'm, you know, like I'm here, I'm trying, we're talking about Michael Mann, and I could only talk at length about like the few of the ones that were probably not going to be brought up in the gonna organically come up in the conversation.
So The Insider was nominated for quite a few awards, including for the 2000 Academy Awards. Was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Writing, Cinematography, Editing, and Best Sound. So
it sounds good.
Yeah,
it's a good sounding movie.
It really is. It is a good sounding movie. I mean, I don't know what other movies it was competing with that year. I don't think it won any. Did it?
No, it didn't.
It was nominated for a bunch, but did not win a single one, which I think is a damn shame, really.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to know the sound, well, I guess this is what we would call sound mixing now is what they call it. The other four nominees in sound category that year were The Matrix, The Green Mile, The Mummy, and The Phantom Menace, and The Matrix won
for sound.
Sound and sound effects. Editing.
I mean, yeah, it was pretty damn good. The Green Mile actually had really good sound. I remember like finding that to be notably good.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I feel like we didn't talk about it much, but it's a movie that I just don't have a lot to say about other than you should just watch it. I mean, it seems like a movie that on the surface may not be that exciting, but it is incredibly captivating.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. We love it.
Yeah. 100%.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to wrap it up for this month. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let us know your favorite 90s adaptations by sending us a message on Twitter and Facebook at 90s pod, or by sending us an email to 90s@filmpulse.com. Also, if you have a moment, consider giving us a review on iTunes. That would be very helpful. Until next month, when we'll be back for another made for TV Christmas.
And oh, will we?
For Ken Bakley, my name is Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.